Successful people learn how to make their mind work for them. I'm David Nagel, and this is the Successful Mind Podcast.
Hey, everybody. It's David Nagel here with a special edition of the Successful Mind Podcast with Dr. Stephanie Estima. And guess what? So this will be your first introduction to Dr. Stephanie, and you're going to get a second introduction to her. I had her on a podcast about a week ago. She was live in my podcast studio. Obviously, we're not doing that now because of the virus, but we got talking about this the other day, and she has such great information that I wanted to get her on right away and get this information out to all of you. So please welcome Dr. Stephanie Estima. How you doing?
I'm doing really well. Thank you for having me again. This is such a treat.
Yeah, it's a blast. I love it. Wait till they hear our second
podcast. It's very different. Opening up my heart and telling everybody, and now we're gonna go on a geeky magic carpet ride on COVID-19 and SARS-CoV-2.
Seriously. Yeah. So from your perspective, what the hell is actually going on out there right now? Because this is something like the world's never seen before. You know, like you mentioned right. SARS there for a minute, you know, and we've had Ebola and we've had other viruses and problems over the years, but nothing quite like this. What's different about this?
So before we go on this nerd safari together, I will just say for the people who are listening, I am not an infectious disease specialist, nor am I an immunologist, but what I am is an excellent amalgamator of information. I can read studies and critique critique them and bring them and amalgamate information for people to understand in, you know, a succinct and easy to understand way. So what we understand about the coronavirus, and this has just been literally since I've come home from recording this podcast with you, has been the focus of all of my attention. So what we know about the coronavirus is that it is a novel virus. We think that it originated in bats and it mutated to be able to transmit from bats to humans. We think that the origin of that is in Wuhan, China. And we can tell when we look at some of the data in terms of the infections. Of course, we have China being, I think as of this morning, it was 81,000 people who had been infected. There's about 3,500 deaths. And then we have other hotspots throughout the world. In Italy being one of them this morning, I think there was about half of that. So 40,000 people infected. They have a higher death rate. So I think they're at 5,000 deaths now. Iran. And now the U.S. is a big hotbed as well, with Spain and France and Germany, all clustered around 20,000 people that have been infected at this point. So why it's different and why it's an important consideration to be paying attention to is that this is a virus that has a different mechanism of action than the seasonal flu or even the original SARS virus. So this virus has now been named SARS-CoV-2. That's the appropriate name for this virus. The original SARS virus, SARS-CoV, from, you may remember that from 2003, especially if you were someone in Canada or China, which were the two biggest countries that were affected by it. This particular virus is much more virulent. It's sneakier, and it has a much higher, at this point in terms of the math, in terms of the pandemic math that I've been paying attention to, has a higher mortality rate. So what I mean by all of that is that when I say virility, I mean that it is highly infectious, meaning that, and we've all heard it can be transferred through respiratory droplets. So if you are talking to someone within 6 feet, you can be infected with the virus. It can also, we've seen reports that it can survive on paper, on cardboard for up to 24 hours, on copper and metal, anywhere from 4 hours to, there's been some reports that have said 5 days, but the average mean there is it can last anywhere from 4 to 72 hours. So things like Amazon packages coming to your home, if they've been recently touched by someone who's infected, the virus is relatively robust in that it can survive the transfer from the warehouse to your home. So really important to be disinfecting all Amazon packages and all mail that's coming into the house, to be opening those things outside or disinfecting them before they come inside. And the other thing that is particularly difficult about SARS-CoV is that for the first couple of days when someone is quite infected and they are able to transfer the virus to other people, they are, for the most part, asymptomatic. And when we look at some of the data that's coming out of China, and now we're starting to see things coming out of Italy, there's a mean or an average of about 5 days where someone can be infected with this virus and be completely asymptomatic. Like, they may have some general feelings of malaise, maybe a headache or, you know, a general sense of not feeling well. But before some of the classic signs, so cough, you know, a dry cough, so not productive, not phlegmy, but dry, a fever or shortness of breath, which is the other thing that's common in SARS-CoV and not things like allergies or the original SARS or the flu, that shortness of breath. Before you start to display those symptoms, you could be passing them around to whoever. It can be living on surfaces. If you live in a building, of course, we know that there's vectors of infection like elevator buttons,
right,
door handles, you know, sitting at a table, or, you know, even being on an airplane with the little table tray. If someone has been infected on that and then you get off the plane and then someone else gets on, you know, you can be infected through those very common vectors of infection.
And how many days before we show symptoms are we infectious?
About 5 days.
About 5 days before. So my understanding, it's 12 to 14 before we start showing symptoms. Is that correct?
It used to be 12 to 14. That was the original sort of like, and it's so interesting because information is changing so quickly.
Okay.
The first special episode that I did on my podcast, the data at that time was 12 to 14 days where you can be asymptomatic. And
tell everybody what your podcast is so they know.
It's called Better with Dr. Stephanie. So right now, that's all we're pushing out is coronavirus content for people. So whether that's information about the virus, I've just recently interviewed an infectious disease specialist. I've just put out one on anxiety and fear, which I'd love to talk to you about as well. So it's called Better with Dr. Stephanie. And so it's what we've done is what they've done is the data now, it used to be 12 to 14 days and now we're accepting a mean of 5 days. So you can sick with it for about 5 days and then you're going to start to exhibit some sort of symptoms.
Okay.
Now the good news in all of this is about 81% of the time. So the official number is 80.8, but we can round up to 81. The virus is relatively mild. Of people that we know that are infected with it, 80% of the time, it can be managed at home. Now, the problem and the reason why this is, the whole world is paying attention to it, is in the 20% of the time when it is not mild, it can progress to more severe pulmonary or cardiovascular insults. So things like pneumonia, you can have swelling and fluid accumulation in the lungs. We've seen they've reported on some of the literature on autopsies that they've done where there's so much damage to the membrane. So where we exchange gas in the lungs, it's called the alveolar capillary barrier. There's so much damage there that you can't actually get oxygen in through the alveoli. And then of course, push it out through the bloodstream to the rest of your tissues and organs. And, This is a life-threatening situation. Like if you can't get oxygen into the rest of your body, it's something that's called acute respiratory distress syndrome.
Yeah.
And that's what the big conversation in the States and in Canada is this idea of ventilation. So someone who has ARDS, someone who has acute respiratory distress syndrome, they're going to require some sort of ventilation or mechanical intubation where there's literally someone literally has to shove an air pipe in there and like force oxygen into the body. And the data that we have, at least in the U.S., I'm based in Canada and you can't find any information on Canadian ICU beds. Like, it's like, I don't know. I've been looking for it. I can't find it. So if somebody has it, I'd love to see it. But in the States, we know that there's 95,000 beds that are dedicated for intensive care. And you can imagine that with the exponent, the amount of infection, the virility of this virus is so potent that if we have 20% of 330 million, which is about the population of the United States, that's far more than 95,000, right? So sure. This is where the concern is around this virus, is that 20% of people. And we can talk about the people who are more likely to have more serious complications as well, if you'd like, David, or we can talk about the immune response. I'm happy to go wherever you would like.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions. So the 20% of 30 million, that's what we're worried about now, that peaks too fast and we don't have enough beds or medical equipment or doctors or anything to be able to take care of that. And that's kind of what Northern Italy is experiencing right now. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So unfortunately, what's happening now, and I think I read a paper yesterday where they think that there's a different strain in Italy because we're seeing a much higher mortality rate there than anywhere else. Yeah, and they have half the amount of cases of China and more deaths. So that could be a latency in response. You know, we saw that China and some other countries took very drastic, draconian-like measures. And maybe that might be the reason why they were able to get it under control early. But in Italy, unfortunately now, what's happening is they've run out of ventilators. They have healthcare workers who no longer get breaks, who are all being exposed to the virus. And we can talk a little bit about, you know, the quality of the host. But if you have a healthcare provider who is working 24/7, they're not getting breaks, they're stressed out of their minds, and they're having to make, unfortunately, really difficult decisions in terms of who gets a ventilator and who doesn't. And often what we've seen, which is heartbreaking, is that they're giving the ventilators to some of the younger people who are infected, right, and not the older people, because their mortality rates are much higher.
Yeah, they're triaging death. Like literally
they're choosing. Yeah. And this is like the worst way to play God. I mean, this is just you're having to choose who lives and who dies. And, there's a real cost there. I mean, if it's your grandmother or your like that, that would just be a horrible decision for you to have to learn about. Sure. But also when we think about, you know, the doctors and the cost of the, you know, you lose a doctor or a nurse, like it takes many, many years to train a proficient doctor with clinical experience to fall back on. I mean, I remember when I first, you know, the way that my first patient was cared for when I got out of school is very different than the patients that saw me 10 years into practice, 15 years into practice, et cetera, because the clinical experience that comes with working in scenarios like that it's, you can't train that. So,
Okay. Mm-hmm. At the very beginning, you said that it's a novel virus. What does that mean exactly? I don't understand that term.
Sure. Yeah, that's. Thank you for asking. So, novel means that it is something that that humans have not been exposed to before. So, this is a virus. At least the papers that I have read are suggesting that this is a virus that was primarily confined to bats, and some point, this virus was able to mutate and be able to be infectious to humans. So a novel, when we think about the flu, for example, like the seasonal flu, we know that the flu like the strains of the flu, they will mutate, every year, multiple times, over the course of that season. But we typically have some protection to that because we already have some antibodies, even if we don't have full immunity or full antibodies to the entire strain of the flu. We typically have partial immunity to pieces of it because our bodies have seen it before. So this is why, we can talk about the flu shot and its efficacy rates, but we often find when they're developing a flu shot, what they're trying to do is they will model how they think last year's strain is going to mutate into this year's strain and then create something based out of that. But we know that there's, we already have partial immunity to the flu every year because we already have pieces, if we've been exposed to it and we're able to handle it appropriately, the natural, immunological response is to create antibodies against it.
Okay. In Canada, the United States, when do you think, or based on the research that you're doing, because one of the big things down here in the States is they keep talking about, especially today, like it's been a big conversation on the news, that, as a matter of fact, the government, the governor of New York talked about this today, because I took it and I was teaching around it earlier, that he is proposing, in his opinion, in his educated opinion, mm-hmm. we're looking at 6 to 9 months before we start to get back to normal. So this is much longer than they originally said. Mm-hmm. And the reason that he's giving is that we have not seen the peak of this yet, and he doesn't think we're really close to seeing the peak of this yet. Based on, and they're basing this primarily on the way the COVID traveled through China and China's response to it. Mm-hmm. What's interesting, though, is that in the United States, even though we currently have 5 states basically under lockdown now, we have a tremendous amount of people that are not, and we have a tremendous amount of people that think that this is just a freaking joke. Out yesterday quite a bit, and I was watching people interact, and there's people that are, like a lot of people. The governor of New York was saying that he saw the same thing in the parks in New York City, and they're not paying attention to the fact that we're asking to social distance and that we're asking to be really mindful of what's going on. I've actually heard inside conversations where people think that this is a total joke. So in the question, this has been kind of a long-winded question, how long do you think until we see the peak of this, where we actually start to flatten that curve?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and I don't have the answer. I don't know. I think that when we look at China, who took relatively aggressive measures, the life cycle, I think it was yesterday or the day before, they reported no new cases. There was one day that they reported no new cases, and it's been steadily declining since the end of February. So,
but isn't it 2 months that they've had people basically quarantined in their home at this point?
It's been 2 months since 2 months. They've had those. Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Okay.
But so that's like the hammer that you need to, I think that, and this is why, and I say this not in any attempt to criticize people at the CDC or in the government, but right. It just seems like a colossal failure to communicate the importance of this in a timely manner. And if we had people that were actively social distancing, this is also like, dear Florida, like, please go back to, like, stop like partying on the beaches and having your spring break and all this kind of stuff.
Since shut the beaches down since that became
an issue.
I hear you, and I'm concerned that we haven't done enough to shut that down. Mm-hmm. I'm not looking to get into the rhetoric around this or the politicization, whatever, mm-hmm. around this.
The politics, yeah.
Yeah, the politics. Yeah. But like if you're like a person who's just paying attention can see that if we don't do something and people aren't taking enough care to do this, it'll blow out of proportion like it is in Italy. Like, right. Our numbers are really starting to climb here in the
state. They are. Yeah. And they're hovering around 20,000 as of today,
You
know, a week ago it was, it was 1500, 1600. Like it is growing. I agree with you. I think that people really do need to be taking the social distancing, or at least people are starting to reframe it as physical distancing, like at least physically distance yourself, and particularly for the people who are at most risk. So, we know that age is the biggest predictor in terms of who might have a more severe reaction to this virus. So we're at about 60 years of age, we start to see the mortality rates jump in those populations. We have to be careful with all of our grandparents. If you're living with somebody who's older at home, people who are obese, they are already, there's metabolic derangement. They're already inflamed. Type 1 and type 2 diabetes. This population, again, higher risk, hypertension, cardiovascular disease. All these sort of, and we were talking about this a little bit in the pre-chat before we started, but all of these diseases, with the exception of type 1 diabetes, are all pro-inflammatory, like these people are already inflamed. And this particular virus will profit off of that, because what it does is it creates this immune system reaction. So once you're kind of shutting down and you're damaging some of these lung cells that we were talking about a moment ago, your immune system gets all revved up and it's like, okay, we got to go to the lungs. We got to fix what's going on. We got to remove this virus. And there can be something that's called a cytokine storm. In the most extreme cases, I'll give you an example. Like imagine you have, to explain what a cytokine storm is, you have an invader that's coming into your home.
Okay.
And you're trying to resist the invader, and the invader is pushing and he's getting in, and it's becoming more of a desperate situation. So as a homeowner, you say, okay, like this is a desperate situation. Like if I don't stop this guy from coming, or this girl, this invader from coming there's going to be dire consequences here. So I have to get out my shotgun. So you take out your shotgun and you just end up, shooting everywhere and everything to try and get rid of this invader. And in the process, you end up shooting yourself by accident. So that's what a cytokine storm is that you have this huge inflammatory response. You send all these cytokines down into the lungs. And the intent of that is to try and get rid of some of this inflammation so that you can actually get that oxygen. But what ends up happening is those cytokines, it overwhelms the system and the lungs just collapse. So we really do, like to your original point around taking this seriously, it really is important, especially when we think about the obesity rates in the States. I checked this the other day. It's like 42 and change, 42% of the population considered obese. To the Canadians that are listening who like to punt the schema that their fat cousins to the South are the only ones with this problem. We are over the age of 18 in Canada, 64% of us are obese. So this is a huge problem for North Americans. Like we are just overweight, we're inflamed, and now we have this pandemic where people are, and you can see people who are not taking it seriously and saying, well, this is my right as an American to sit at. I saw a tweet from, I forget her name. I think they call her the AOC. She was a candidate for the Democratic League. What's her name? It's like, she has a Latin name. I forget her name, but she put out some tweet that said, stay at home, practice social distancing. And someone responded to her and said, I'm an American. I went to Red Lobster. I took my time. I had my dessert. I'm an American. I'm going to do what I want. There's this sort of sense of entitlement around like, this is anti-American, like for you to, or anti-freedom, for you to tell me to stay at home. And at this point, I think it's our civic duty to stay at home, to protect those who are more vulnerable to it, but also just to not overwhelm the system. Like I said, it takes a long time to train some of these ER docs and some of these healthcare workers, and they're not easily replaceable.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think it's totally our civic duty to do that. And I think there's a lot of people, the actual Constitution is coming into a lot of question right now in what Trump has the right to do, what the government has the right to do, and what individual, Trump really can't, to my understanding, Trump really can't make everybody stay home without declaring martial law in our country.
Okay.
So, and I think that has to do with the Stafford Act and him in engaging that and going down that road. I'm sure that he does not want to do that. That just the sound of it, martial law, scares the shit out of everybody here in the States. Like it hasn't been done for a long, long time. However, the individual states can shut down, the governors of the individual states can shut down those states without doing that and can impose a penalty or a fine upon people that break that rule outside of necessity. So the states that have shut down let you go out for food, they let you go out for emergencies, and all necessary businesses are allowed to stay open based on whatever their qualification for a necessary business is.
Food, like grocery stores.
Yeah, food, grocery. Yeah, like yeah. You can totally go to the grocery store. And I think in a lot of cases, as long as you're not congregating with people, they even let you go out for a walk or a run or something like that. You just can't be out screwing around, hanging around a bunch of people, completely ignoring it. Then they're gonna cite you. They're gonna fine you. In some cases, it's a misdemeanor. In some states, it's a misdemeanor. I don't know if it is in every state, but I know some states it's a misdemeanor.
Yeah.
But here's what I want to get back to, Stephanie. You said something I think is fascinating. I understand it. You understand it. But I think a lot of the listeners to this podcast don't understand it. And that is, what are the inflammatory diseases, and why are they called inflammatory diseases?
So inflammatory means that we are just in a state of more swelling. Like we are more like at a very basic level, there's more edema, there's more swelling, there's more pathways in our body that are activated on a day-to-day basis to try and bring down those levels of inflammation that don't need to be. So when we talk about inflammatory diseases like type 2 diabetes, like cardiovascular disease, hypertension or high blood pressure, being obese. So we calculate obesity through doing something called the BMI. And I can give you the calculator if you want to put in your show notes for your listeners.
Hey, great.
All of these categories, all of these silos, they have sort of one linchpin that connects them all together. I mean, the manifestation is a little different. Maybe you have excess adiposity or excess fat for somebody or fat tissue for someone who's overweight, or you have elevated lipid levels in someone who has cardiovascular disease, or your blood pressure is higher than what it needs to be with someone with hypertension. But the linchpin for all of those things is inflammation. And why you are more susceptible to some of the complicated comorbidities that we discussed with COVID-19 is the virus hacks into your immune system and activates those inflammatory pathways. And if they are already activated because you have these pre-existing conditions, it is going to be much harder for you on a cellular level to have more resilience to the virus. And I know we like to think about the virus as this like big bad wolf that's trying to kill us all, but the virus is just trying to replicate. Like it's just trying to hack into our machinery to reproduce so that it can continue to propagate in the same way that we have children, right? It's right. Like propagation of the species. So it's not this big bad wolf, but you are, if you do become infected with the virus and your cells are strong, like you have what I call cellular grit, right? They have resiliency, kind of like if you have, you know, a bank account and you've been putting, you know, deposits in there, you know, over the course of several years, you know, when it's time to make a withdrawal, there's going to be more in the bank for you to draw on. And the same is true when we talk about inflammatory diseases. If you have been making small withdrawals rather than deposits over the course of time, the cumulative effect is you're going to have less in the bank for you to be able to draw on in order to sustain yourself. So that's why it's important for us, not only in the immediate term to be practicing this physical distancing, but I think that there's an argument in the intermediate and long term for us to take radical responsibility for the state of our health and well-being. And when we look at the behavior of the government, and by no means am I an economist, I can't, you know, or someone who understands the political landscape the way, you know, others might, but you don't need to have a degree in political science to see that the government has failed its people. Mm-hmm. Right. And we often, in times like this, we are so panicked that we delegate our own responsibility to authority figures like the government, like the militia, like whoever we view as an authority figure to keep us safe, right, to keep us protected. And you and I have had lots of conversations around this idea of safety and protection. And at the end of the day, your health is your responsibility. So there's things that we can start to do right now while we're at home to start improving our health. And we can talk about some of those really easy things. And then we want to be practicing them so that they become habitual for us over time. So that over time, we're adding to that bank account. We're adding that resiliency on that cellular level so that if there is something else that comes, and it doesn't have to be a pandemic like this, it can be you know, a really bad flu. It can be a disease. It can be, we have a lot more to withdraw from and to rely on. Like the nest egg is bigger, if that makes sense.
It totally makes sense to me. I'm going to throw some numbers at you. And normally, like if I was teaching just by myself, I would talk about why to stay calm, why to think through decisions, how to evaluate, that type of thing. But I want to try to come from the perspective of the questions that I'm hearing. And one of the questions is the comparison, not just to the flu, but of other different things that kill people every day. So let me throw some numbers at you that I've triple checked with the World Health Organization and various other agencies. So, and these are daily, okay? All the numbers I'm giving you are daily. These are people that die daily of these causes. Worldwide, 337 people die a day in fires. 1,418 people die every day from the flu. 3,792 people die every day from car accidents. Mm-hmm. 7,671 people die every day of general obesity. 25,000 people die every day from hunger, and 47,397,000 people die every day from heart disease. So when we hear somebody saying, well, shit, I mean, look at heart disease, 47,397 people every day, 365 days a year worldwide. Why should we be giving so much attention to this when those numbers don't even approach the numbers that we're seeing from heart disease, and it doesn't cause a worldwide panic?
So the first thing we should be talking about is the exponential rate of infection. And we want to tie this back into the pre-existing conditions. So you said about 47,000 have CVD worldwide.
Yep.
If we've identified cardiovascular disease as a pre-existing condition that can increase your potential for complications from this disease to be worse. So when we think about, before we get there though, let's just talk about an exponential rate of infection. Because the virus can present as asymptomatic for the amount of time that it does, if you are not practicing social distancing, you are going to be spreading it to anyone and everyone that you come in contact with within 6 feet. So we don't now have a linear rate of growth where it's like over the delta T, or if we look at an X and a Y axis, the X axis is your change over time. The amount of infections are going to correlate perfectly. No matter how much time goes on, you're going to have the same rate of infection in a population. That's a linear rate of infection. Okay. With what we've seen with the coronavirus is something called an exponential rate of infection. So if you can imagine, you know, you have your Y axis, you have your X axis, and then you almost have this like inverted C, or like a hockey stick that looks like it's been turned upside down. You have sort of a slow growth initially, and then it just explodes. And when we think about pre-existing conditions like cardiovascular disease, like obesity, like cerebrovascular incident, like stroke, these things all put you at a higher risk. They put you in a higher risk category. And the problem with the exponential rate of infection is the hospital issue that we've talked about. So if you are overwhelming the healthcare system, you know, and anyone who's ever been to a hospital on a good day, you know, pre-corona knows that it's, you know, and I say this with love, but it's a gong show at the best of times, right?
Yeah.
So now you add in this extra disease where it has the potential to completely overwhelm your immune system in a relatively short amount of time. We don't have the beds to accommodate you. We don't have the ventilators to intubate you. You can see how the two things that you're talking about, like the CVD and being in a state of inflammation, can cause catastrophic results to the population. Does that make sense? Am I explaining myself well?
Yeah, no, it totally makes sense. And that also goes along the line with the idea of how fast it peaks and what those numbers could be, because they keep talking about numbers in the millions. in the low millions, but in the millions nonetheless, about as far as people dying at at the peak of what this actually looks like. And I think that part of the problem is that nobody, certainly nobody in my generation, your generation, has ever seen anything like this. This is not something, even if you take the virus away, this kind of a hardship in somebody's life is not something in the advanced civilization we've seen. Not, at least not since World War II. Really?
Yeah, I'd agree.
Where the United States, Canada had to sacrifice in order to defeat a common enemy, right? And you know, Great Britain. But even going beyond, so well, let's just stay up to that point for a moment because there's not anybody really alive beyond that point. So most people have never really experienced the idea that things could be much worse. And life could be very different than we know it to be. So we've built up this society based on agreements of how we're going to treat each other, how we're going to do business, how commerce works, how you know, a civil society actually works, and it keeps advancing. Nobody ever thinks to themselves, well, hell, this is actually a very fragile system, both from the inside and the outside. And something like a foreign invader, most foreign invaders we think of coming like from another country, could collapse this system, but a germ, a virus could collapse this system. Mm-hmm. We hear about it in horror movies. Mm-hmm. We hear about it when people blow other pandemics out of proportion. Of course, every time something comes down the rail, the media has people on that always are doomsdayers, right? So everything is a fucking collapse of the world. And I think that people get kind of immune to it. They don't want to hear it anymore. Like, you know, how many times are you going to cry wolf and nothing ever happens? Which is what happened kind of with Katrina in the United States back in 05, I think.
The
Weather Channel and various other sources kept hyping weather disasters and nothing ever really happened. And then they let their guard down for 5 minutes and Katrina turned into a Category 5 hurricane and destroyed Louisiana. And then everybody was like, well, what the hell did they, you know? And then of course the United States was blamed that they weren't prepared for it. And like, but nobody ever let it in their consciousness that every single problem, every single virus, every single storm needs to be taken on its own merit for what it could cause and what the effect is, and not categorized in with everything else and lumped into, oh, this was just hyperbole and nothing ever happened, and assuming that this one is the same one. Because then we lose the idea of the seriousness behind what it is that we're experiencing, and then nobody takes it serious.
Well, this is the, you know, we used to look to journal, and this is, I just want to make maybe an opinion, this is an opinion, but we used to look to journalists for unbiased, you know, non-hysterical information.
Right.
And particularly here, but you've seen this sort of metamorphosis of the news, especially with 24-hour news cycles. They just want to keep you hooked. It's a business, and they want to keep you hooked. And they will, when SARS, the original SARS-CoV came out, they were estimating it was like a 4 or 5% mortality rate, and it was later. Once they started getting a little bit more data, I was like, okay, and the mortality rate is 1.4% they were estimating it at. And then after the pandemic, like years later, they revised the mortality rate to 0.02 or a 0.03%, which is a 65x change. So the reason why I share that is I think that it's important also to note that we don't have all the information right now. There's going to be a lot of hindsight analysis that comes in. Right now, the only true number that we know is the amount of deaths. We actually don't know in the population who is infected. We think, you know, I've been following the Johns Hopkins University coronavirus tracker.
Me too.
And I think it's I forget the number now. I think it's hovering around 300,000 as of today, or maybe it's a little beyond that, but that's of the people that we know that are infected. There can be a vast majority of other people who have been infected and got over it, never reported it because they didn't think it was anything big. The people were completely asymptomatic for the entire duration of the infection. Like, there's so much more information that we actually don't know. So I want to, in my messaging, I definitely want to be talking about why it's important and what we need to be doing right now, but also recognizing that we don't have all of the information. We don't have all of the data. So we can only do the absolute best that we can do with the information that we have and not panic. And not panic around it, because the mortality rates that we're seeing out in China, they're already being revised to be lower than what they were originally stated.
Yeah, I've heard that. Is it reasonable for people right now, because I'm hearing this a lot on the news, a lot of the questions, is it reasonable for everyone to expect our government, your government, whatever, to know everything about this virus right now? Is that reasonable? Is that just panic? My belief is that it's just panic. Like, we're kind of in a crisis mode. You're not looking at what went wrong now. You're looking at what do we need now, and then evaluating what went wrong over a period of time so that it doesn't happen again. It's like, it's too late right now, right? So we have to deal with the crisis first. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to hear your opinion on it.
I don't think it's possible to have all the information right now. I think what we can do is look at models that came before us. So looking at China, looking at Italy, looking at Iran, looking at Germany and France and Spain, and looking at the things that they did right and the things that they did wrong. And we can also look at outliers like Taiwan and South Korea, where we see that they doubled because they had they were hit very hard by SARS-CoV in 2003. They had the testing, everyone was being tested. The amount of testing in South Korea, I think, was something like 10,000. I don't have the accurate numbers, but it's something like 10,000 tests per day. And in the States, I think we've, as of yesterday, because I was just speaking to an infectious disease specialist, like 34,000 people in total have been tested, which is 3 days in South Korea, you know? So, yeah. The responsive rate, when we look at South Korea, when we look at Taiwan, and we look what has been done right by those governments and the early implementation of some of these social distancing and, you know, potentially draconian measures versus places like Italy where they waited, Spain, France, where they were reporting, you know, there was a point where they were reporting, you know, 20, 30 deaths. And you can extrapolate from that the amount of people who you think are infected, right? Like, if it is a 1% mortality rate, you know, if you've had 20 deaths, you know, all you have to do is just kind of do the reverse math and know that there's a lot more people infected than that you currently know.
Right. Yeah. Well, one of the things that I think is very interesting, and it's definitely up for peer review and debate, especially when this is over, is the readiness, especially of our government. And, you know, I always like to play devil's advocate with anything because I want to try to understand the other side's point of view.
Yeah.
But with this, you know, one of the things that I think that the hysteria is preventing for people to look at, because they're saying, like, how come the United States was not more prepared for this? Well, if we think about the history of legislation, doesn't matter the administration. Every administration has had its own agenda as far as preparedness, say, for the military or something like this or various other things. The pushback on the funding for those things is astronomical. They're to the point where they get really nasty about it in a lot of ways. And I know, like, when you have an administration in our country who they're looking to bolster the military, they say that it's not needed. We're in a different world. Mm-hmm. It's a waste of the money. We need to put money towards education, blah, blah, blah. It just goes all the way down whatever the other side feels is important at that time. So I can imagine if somebody, doesn't matter what administration, I'm not on any side here, if somebody said, hey, we need to be prepared for a worldwide pandemic, and we let the professionals determine what a worldwide pandemic would look like and everything that we need, we'd be in the hundreds of billions of dollars to prepare for something like that. And still we wouldn't be prepared just from a human resource standpoint, that they would never get something like that past Congress, most likely. It would negotiate it. It would get lowered down eventually. What I'm saying is that we would not end up prepared to begin with.
Right.
So I think the idea that I wanted to present to you and ask you is there any way for somebody to prepare for something like this when we actually don't know what the hell the thing's going to do to begin with?
I think that there are ways that we can prepare.
There are. Okay.
I think that in terms of, you know, government mandates, I mean, that's not my specialty, but I think in terms of developing, even though we don't necessarily have a program or a fallback to say, okay, like when this happened back in, you know, 1918, this is what we did and this is how we got through it. Even though we don't necessarily have that schema, I think that getting in the habit of doing difficult things on a regular basis, I think develops both, you know, physical and mental toughness. And I think that when we look at ourselves as a society, when we're looking forest from the trees, I think we are generally an inflamed, overweight, and uninitiated society. And I'm sorry if that's triggering or it's a hard truth.
It's true. It's a numbers. It's the truth. It's not a judgment on your part.
Yeah, it's not a judgment. It's a call to action. It's a call to say, okay, so now I have been presented with this potential contagion. What is it that I can do, that I can start to do to begin to improve my mental resilience around this, to not fall privy to the, you know, to have someone say to me, she's not leaving her house because she's convinced that the wind is carrying the virus now. Like she will not go outside. To be making decisions from that area in your brain, you are not making decisions that are going to serve you. You are making survival decisions. And I think that we can, you know, hold space for ourselves to feel those feelings. I think it's okay to be fearful. It's okay to be scared, but you also have to be able to parent yourself out of that, to be able to say, okay, I'm feeling scared, but what's the next immediate step that I can take to help get me into, you know, I would call this like your prefrontal cortex or into your executive center, where you're making decisions that are sound and they're not fear-based. Right. And of course you can talk to, I mean, you were on my podcast talking about your story with the dam. I mean, if you were making decisions that were panicked when your hands were all, you know, skinned, you probably wouldn't have had the foresight to, you know, to weave the branch through your, through your life vest. So I think when we get out of our limbic, we get out of that lizard brain and start developing things that, you know, almost develop the muscle in our brain, so to speak. So things like meditation, breath work, journaling, even things that feel uncomfortable, like taking cold showers every day. I mean, that when I first started doing it, I thought this was like the worst punishment I could give myself on the planet. Yeah. But doing something difficult every single day makes you stronger. You are grittier. You are more resilient. You have more perseverance than someone who's not. So I definitely think there's things we can be doing around our mental health that can help us. And I think around our our psychology and then our physiology as well. So things like, and the cold shower actually is a crossover. It's really good for your mental grit, but it's also really good for the cells to be able to produce energy, and it wakes you up. And it's, you know, there's all these, something called mitochondrial biogenesis, that when you are in freezing cold water, or when you're in actually the other extreme, which is heat, you start to birth new cells that create energy. So you're more energetic. Getting rid of the, you know, standard American diet, and whatever that means for you. Like literally, if you go keto, you go paleo, you go carnivore, you go vegan, anything is better than the standard American diet. You will have profound physiological changes by just cutting out the sodas and the processed foods and the refined carbohydrates and the artificial sweeteners.
Yeah.
I think there's things we can all be doing right now to be improving and taking, and this kind of comes back to, you know, the host versus the germ. Like the germ is virulent. The germ is like a nasty bugger, but we can also create strength in ourselves by doubling down on our health. And I think that like there's no better time. Like the reason why it's showing up is the reason why it needs to show up right now. Like we need to, we need to do something.
Yeah. Do you think that there's any medical logic around or any scientific proof around this idea that I keep hearing being thrown around now? So you were talking about earlier that there might be different strains of this. Another thing that I'm hearing on top of that is that this may affect people with a different genome than others differently. So I don't know if you're aware of this, but we have a family here in the United States where four people in the same family died from COVID.
Okay.
And I was not aware. It was like a week ago. Yeah. So apparently they had a big dinner with the immediate family, and there was a guest at the dinner. The guest had, he was positive. He didn't know he was positive. He passed it on to the family. So far, four people in the family have died from it and that were at that dinner, and several others are currently have it. And I hear that some others are getting worse. Mm-hmm. But so they were talking about the different ways that are affecting people all over the world. And then in China, they were referring to how it killed more men than women. And originally they thought they traced that back to smoking, but then now they're not sure. And they're thinking that there could be a genetic disposition to death here. I've also heard blood types. Mm-hmm. It could be affecting different blood types. You have anything on any of that or?
No, in terms of blood types, I have not heard that. I have heard and read similar things to you, like the thinking around the increased mortality with men in China was that they culturally smoke more than the females do.
Right.
So that gives them that extra pre-existing condition. I wouldn't be surprised if there is a genetic predisposition and wherever that might be with a particular, constitution in the lung or in the heart or in the liver or in the kidney. I don't have any insight there whatsoever, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's some variability there that makes a certain type of person more susceptible to than another.
Okay. All right. So if a person they're listening to this and they're like, okay, I want to take responsibility for my own outcome here, especially futuristically. What can a person start doing now, besides cutting out the obvious, which you stated, to start bolstering their own immune system to fight this off in the worst case scenario that they end up with it? Because they're saying here that 70 to 80, maybe even more of a percentage of people will ultimately get it over a period of time.
Yeah, the data that I've read is between 40 and 70% of the population. So that's okay. I know it's a big wide, that's a really wide range.
Right.
But you can assume that at some point, somebody that you know or you yourself will become infected with it. So the easiest thing that anybody can start doing right now is sleep. So we've been talking about nutrition and we were talking about, you know, cold showers and things. But before we even get to that, let's just pinky promise each other that we're going to sleep, that we're going to sleep for 8 hours every single night. Because when we think about boosting our immune system, that's one of the most natural ways on the planet to do it. If you have a proper night's sleep, your brain has been effectively washed, because that's what happens overnight, is your something called your glymphatic system literally like cleans your brain like it's going through a car wash. And one of the other things that I didn't mention this, but there's been a few case studies out of China where they've seen that the virus is able to infect and cause encephalitis. So it can, and maybe this is a genetic predisposition as well, but it's able to cross the blood-brain barrier and cause swelling on the brain. So when we sleep, we are cleaning the brain, we are priming ourselves to be motivated. We will, make better choices, because the area in our brain that makes executive decisions is online and we are not operating from our limbic system. So I always tell people, kind of tongue in cheek and, as a joke, but if you want like the cheapest diet in the world, is 8 hours of sleep for the next 7 days. Like you'll see your cortisol levels drop, you'll see your hormones regulate, and you don't have to, before you pay money to work with me. Just like sleep for 8 hours a night for 7 days and see how much weight you lose. So sleep would be something I would strongly recommend. I would put boundaries around the amount of information that you're taking in. Like we know at the best of times, social media can have derogatory effects on our mental health. People are now isolated. They're not seeing their friends. They're not seeing their family. And most of our information now is coming from scrolling aimlessly, you know, and you see your neighbor's opinion on COVID and, you know, anybody's doing Facebook Lives and Instagram things. And so you are, there's a, this barrage of information that I think can be detrimental. So I would set hard boundaries around the amount of information that you're taking in and only take information in from, you know, non-biased sources. So the WHO, the CDC, the John Hopkins tracker is something that I'm following. And I mean, I've personally had my face buried in PubMed for the past 2 weeks, but for people that are not, that doesn't apply to everybody. But, you know, 2 or 3 times a day maximum is when I would go in and see if there's any updates on there. But always being on Facebook, always being on Instagram, this is just going to
or the traditional news like CNN, Fox or MSNBC, like it's all it's all pretty crazy right now.
Yes. So not I have not watched, I didn't even think to say that. So thank you. I have not watched the news in years because they, you know, they never report on the planes that land, right? It's always like doom.
That's doomsday, a good one. Yeah, exactly. You know, crazy. I had a friend that used to say CNN was constantly negative news.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So boundaries on how much information you're taking in. And then I would start with something really simple, like maybe some breath work, you know, like just getting into your body and out of your head, because your head can just like, you can just spiral really quickly. Like what if this and what if that and the future is this and like all you have is right now. So just getting into your body and holding space for you to either feel the feelings that you're having, whether that's fear, anxiety, you know, and maybe you are thinking about the future. Give yourself permission there, but then bring yourself out of it and bring yourself into your breath and into your body. I think that, and it can sometimes feel much safer in your body, you know, than online and consuming information and being, you know, engaging in the exterior world. So those would be like my 1, 2, 3. For people, I know there's a lot of questions around supplementation, and I have given recommendations on supplementation, you know, in the recent weeks, but supplements are, just as the name suggests, a supplement. They are an addition to foundational habits around health. So the sleep, the movement, you know, the nutrition, the breath work, the mindset work, the boundaries, the personal boundaries that you're setting, like those are foundational to your health. Like you can't vitamin C your way out of it. You know, if you are just eating Doritos all day long and not moving, no amount of vitamin C is really going to make a difference there. It's a supplement to,
it doesn't kill anything. It doesn't kill. It's not a, a vaccine. What I saw the other day that I thought was pretty good for like all the religious people. They said, Jesus is not a vaccine. Stay at home.
Right. And we know what's really great is we're seeing so much innovation. Like we're seeing churches that are broadcasting over video conferencing, like you and I are talking right now. We're seeing, you know, people get really creative. They're moving from in-person events to virtual events. We're seeing all this creativity and innovation. And on some level, I also feel like this is a, you know, an opportunity to change the way that we have been doing things. So to, you know, and there was a virtual event that I was not able to attend in real life that happened over this weekend that I was able to attend. So it was, you know, it was really, really lovely to see, you know, people that I know, love and respect that I would have missed out on.
Right.
Otherwise. So, yeah.
That's really great. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. There has been some question around the idea, if you do get sick with this, about how to take care of yourself. And one of the things that I heard was that not to take ibuprofen or Motrin, to stick with paracetamol, Tylenol, acetaminophen products to deal with the fever and the aches and pains. Anything true or valid about that?
There is a raging debate right now with that. So what we are seeing, and I would just want to exercise caution here, is we've been talking about in the past week, the medical community and everybody who's paying attention to this, we have been focusing on the ACE2 receptor. So people who are on angiotensin receptor blocker medication, like maybe they're going to be more susceptible to the virus. Oh, no, wait, no, now they're less susceptible to the virus. So like we don't know. So ibuprofen is another one where we're like, oh my God, don't take ibuprofen. It upregulates the ACE2 receptor. And because it upregulates the ACE2 receptor, it allows for the virus to bind to that receptor and gain access. And then there's just the equal amount of evidence that suggests the opposite, that ibuprofen downregulates the ACE2 receptor. So at this point, I think it's very fair to say that we just do not know. So if it were me and I became sick with it, the way that I would deal with it would be lots of bed rest, adequate, you know, hydration, be monitoring my vital signs and making sure that my oxygen saturation is adequate. So you can get these little, and I'll give you a link for the show notes, like these little finger monitors that you can just place on your finger and it'll read you your oxygen saturation level. So normal level should be 98% and above. So 98, 99 or 100. If you are sick, you know, and you are under the care of your, you know, primary healthcare provider, you want to be just monitoring your blood chemistry. So we want to be looking at your liver enzymes, your cardiac function, like a blood panel, and looking at some labs there. And then if you need oxygen, you know, that's, they're also playing around with some anti-malarials as well. So chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine.
Yes, I've heard a lot about that.
As a potential medication. So there's that. There's some anti-protozoans as well that they're playing with. But the answer right now is that we just don't know.
So the word that they keep associating to those antivirals that are the malaria drugs is anecdotal. What does that actually mean? What does anecdotal mean? And the reason I ask this is because a gentleman was on the news who knows the very well-known doctor in Paris, I believe, that did this study. Mm-hmm. And supposedly he did it with 40 patients that had the virus. And then in the States, there was a gentleman on 2 days ago from Colorado who went to the hospital, was tested positive. 2 days later, they asked him if he wanted to take one of those malaria drugs. They said they couldn't promise him anything, but does he want to try it? At that point, he was already on oxygen. They gave it to him 24 hours. He was like 85% better. So what does anecdotal mean?
Anecdotal means that it hasn't been studied in a traditional sense. So when we say, and right now those anti-malarials that you're describing are being used off-label, meaning that they're not being used for the original reason why they're on the market. So an anecdotal is basically an anecdote. It's a story. So it's an observation that a clinician has made and said, oh, well, you know, this chloroquine or this hydroxychloroquine, we've noticed that in 40 patients or 80 patients or whatever it is, they're getting better. So we don't know if it's the way for it to not be anecdotal would be for there to be a proper, what's called a randomized controlled trial, where we have a group that is receiving the intervention and a group that is not receiving the intervention. And so we would want to look at maybe the group that was not receiving the intervention would receive a placebo. So they think that they're receiving it, but they're not. And then there's also the placebo effect as well, which is typically like 33% effective. It's like the one consistent thing in medicine across all studies, across everything. The placebo effect is the most reliable.
Shows you how powerful the mind is, right?
That's right. That's right. So is the nocebo effect, which is if you don't believe it's going to work, then you will, then you can create a physiological response that is aligned with that. So anecdotal just basically means that there's been an observation clinically, and what will likely happen from that is that they will take this when they are trying to create more medicines from it, that they will probably take it and test it in more of an official way, which would be a randomized controlled trial.
Cool. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. Yeah, well, hopefully, I mean, I know that they've released thousands of batches of that here in the States, especially to New York, California. I'm not sure what other states, but hopefully we'll know soon if that's actually going to make an impact. How's Canada handling this right now?
Right now we have, I think there's 1,100 or 1,200 confirmed cases. We have about 10 or 11 deaths, so lagging quite behind the U.S., but not for long. Again, same sort of suggestion of social distancing, but there's nothing that's been firm. So I am in Toronto, which is the largest city in Canada. We have no schools right now. Museums, government buildings, things like that are all shut down. But public transit is still open. To my knowledge, and I may be wrong on this, I have to fact check myself, but I think there's still like you can still, like if you want to go Toronto to Montreal, you know, the trains are still open. You can probably get a plane, although I don't know about the airplanes, but trains and, you know, you can still travel freely in the country.
Like with the school shutting down, is that left up city to city, or is that Trudeau, or what, like, what is that? How does that
work?
That's
the province. So the province is like a state, the equivalent of a state, in the US. So it's province wide. So the entire province of Ontario, there's no schools, and we just had our March break. So there was no school anyway this past week, but now for a further 2 weeks, there's going to be, no school. So we are all teachers as of tomorrow. So I'll be homeschooling my children as well. So learning how to navigate that is going to be an additional challenge for me. But I have some good online resources that I'm going to be working with.
That's fantastic. That'll be fun. It'll be fun. It is a challenge for sure. If people want to hear, tell everybody what your podcast is again and how people get a hold of you if they want to learn more from you, because your stuff is absolutely fascinating.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So the podcast is called Better with Dr. Stephanie. So it's, we're all pod, you know, we're on Spotify, iTunes, you know, Google Podcasts, anywhere that you would listen to a podcast. We are trying to put out as many special editions around the coronavirus as we can. So a lot of the things that I discussed with you, I have in special updates on the pod. I just released a podcast, just a new episode, just a couple of hours ago on anxiety and fear and how to mitigate it. So some of the things we talked about around boundaries, I go into breath work, like how we can activate our parasympathetic nervous system. Things like holding space for ourselves and giving ourselves permission to feel all of our feelings. And then I trying to get a podcast that I interviewed yesterday, an infectious disease specialist on Corona and some of the antimalarials that we were talking about, other biologics that he's exploring and that has seen working in the field. So that'll be out in the next couple of days as well. But typically, you know, outside of the coronavirus, the whole through line of the podcast is to live a better life, like, you know, better families, better relationships, better body, better sex, better everything. So that's the through line of the podcast. So you can find me there or on Instagram. I'm pretty active there. So it's at Dr. Stephanie Estima.
Great. If this goes a little bit longer, were you interested in doing another one? We'll do an update.
I would love to.
All right. I think everybody would really like that. So they're constantly, I really like to provide the best information that I can for everyone without the BS that goes along with it, because it's so hard. Like, I totally agree with you, like your sources, like I recommend the same sources, or if you can watch the news and just take the facts and then double check them for yourself without getting emotionally involved in, you know, the death to everyone type of a thing. That's pretty cool. Listen, I want to thank you so much for taking your Sunday to do this. And I want to thank your family for that too, because I know that they need your attention very much. So thank you very much. It was wonderful, and you're a brilliant woman.
Thank you very much, David. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Successful Mind Podcast. And if you like what you heard and you want to know more, go to davidnagel.com/freestuff.